Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Working in health professions can be emotionally challenging. Many enter the fields from a genuine desire to help others and alleviate suffering. But it's no secret that becoming a doctor can be an arduous journey, one that can often cause practitioners to harden and learn habits that detach them from joy and impulses that bring them to the healing arts in the first place. My guest today recounts his own challenges along the pathway in a new memoir about his residency years. Adam Stern is a neuropsychiatrist on the staff at Beth Israel Deaconess Hospital in Boston, where he studies transcranial magnetic stimulation in the treatment of depression and other conditions. His new memoir is called Committed: Dispatches from a Psychiatrist in Training. In the book, Stern recounts the challenges he faced, from a feeling of imposter syndrome to loneliness during his training to guilt about his inability to help some of his patients. Along the way, he found love and fought a challenging diagnosis himself. Dr. Adam Stern, neuropsychiatrist and author of the new memoir, Committed, is my guest today on Studio Tulsa Medical Monday. Dr. Adam Stern, welcome to Medical Monday. Your book, Committed, a memoir of your years in training, I guess what's interesting is you didn't always feel like a real doctor even after you had graduated medical school, and I think many of us suffer from this, but you write very compellingly about suffering from imposter syndrome right at the outset. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes, first of all, thank you so much for having me on. And you're absolutely right. I suffered from imposter syndrome. And then only in later years, as I looked back, did I really think, you know, I think imposter syndrome is pretty ubiquitous in medicine across the board, especially in the early years, the years of training. And the reason for that is that medicine is self-selecting for people who are high achieving. They've always done the right thing. They've gotten good grades. They've gone and done everything they can to get into medical school, to work really. You can't get through medical school without working really hard. And then finally, you end up in a place that you've matched at. And what I mean by that is a computer algorithm spits out where you're going to do your training. And in my case, it was at Harvard, and I was coming from a state school in New York, and I had this imposter complex build up because I was thinking, do I really belong here? Was there some sort of computer malfunction? But the more I got to know my classmates, the more I realized everyone was experiencing some degree of this, because you look around and you see people who don't seem like they're struggling, but in your inner world, you're learning on the job, as all residents do. And so I do think imposter syndrome is across the board in medicine.
Yes, I think you're really onto something there, and I think that that's true. Did you ever, you know, throughout the memoir, you talk a little bit about it, and then you kind of come to the revelation that your peers, your classmates, are also dealing with various levels of imposter syndrome. Is there ever a point when you get over it?
That's an interesting question, because I think that to some degree you come to accept it for what it is, which is a neurotic thought, you know, that doesn't necessarily leave you alone, but that you can live with, right? And so we all have self-doubts, most of us anyway, from time to time. And as long as they're not dominating the way that you go about your life and your work, and if you can do your job well and carve out a career that you're proud of, you know, it's okay to have certain neuroses and certain thoughts about, am I good enough for this position? Yes, I am. Look at all the data over the last 10 years that I've been working with patients and working in academic medicine. So the more experience you get, you do develop the tools to deal with it, I think. You don't quite ever, for me anyway, it never quite leaves, you know, there's still just every once in a blue moon, there's just a thought that, maybe today's the day that they'll realize there was a computer glitch and I wasn't actually meant to train there at all. You know, that kind of thing. So it's an irrational thought, but it never quite leaves.
I think in some ways it's good. It keeps you on your toes. You know, medicine is definitely a profession that keeps us humble, you know, because there's always something new to learn and there's always something you haven't seen before. Adam, I want to ask about some of the patients that you care for. And you write beautifully and you sort of reveal to the readers that, you know, you're protecting people's privacy. So you're changing some of the characteristics of the people in the book. But nevertheless, there is a particular category of a patient who had an eating disorder who you wrote about very, very troublingly and movingly, really suffered. And she really called you out. She really knew the system. She'd been a patient for a long time and had been hospitalized many times and sort of said, hey, rookie, hey, intern, and I guess made you feel insignificant. But eventually you kind of won her trust. And it was very sad because at one point it seemed like she had sort of turned the corner, but she wound up suffering. But later there was, you know, another patient, and so it brought back some of these feelings for you. But I guess tell us what it is about this particular diagnosis, or you know, what were some of the highlights or lowlights of those situations?
Absolutely. I think those two patient characters really have several lessons and themes that they're conveying to the reader and that they taught me at the time. One of which is that eating disorders, when they're severe, can be incredibly devastating. And in particular, a lot of patients with eating disorders, anorexia nervosa, bulimia nervosa, patients are very often very intelligent. They don't have necessarily mental illness beyond this particular problem. And they, for whatever reason, more often than not, they tend to be high-achieving people. And so there is a certain intimidation that new psychiatrists feel, I think, when working with patients with eating disorders, because it's a very difficult thing to treat. There's not a single class of medication that's known to help dramatically. You know, it's usually a sort of a mix of trying out different medication classes and seeing what helps. And there's a lot of behavioral therapy, which is a hard thing to do. And there's a lot built into the diagnosis about control. And when you are a patient with a severe illness, you, by definition of the system, you sort of have to give up a lot of your control. And in the book, there's a lot written about the dilemma that I face as a trainee physician, a psychiatrist in training, needing to take away people's freedoms. That's something that still to this day doesn't sit well with me. In the case of the character that you're referring to, at some point there's like a court order for her to be being fed against her will. And even that degree of treatment against her will, even that didn't save her life in the sense that sometimes one of the other lessons that comes across with these patients is sometimes you can do everything right and you can even help a patient and there can still be a negative outcome. As a medical doctor, you know, outside of psychiatry, I'm sure that's something that you've experienced as well, where there's a certain tragedy in feeling like the outcome was inevitable, even and trying to find solace in the idea that maybe I did help them even though it didn't end well. There was still a process where there was value in our connection and our treatment.
Yeah, and there's a very poignant scene where you're at the bedside of one of these patients and she's basically sleeping or slipping in and out of consciousness, and she sort of recognizes that you're there, and at that point it seems like she has built up a trust for you, and as you point out, there really was almost nothing you could do, and yet you were just there to bear witness, and it was very moving.
Thank you very much, and you're hitting on something that really I wanted to get across in several of the patients that we follow throughout the book, which spans the 4 years of my training, which is that even one of the, this is going to sound so incredibly basic, but one of the core tenets of psychiatry is holding emotions with a patient, being present with a patient. And so there are at least two examples that I can think of off the top of my head where just actually probably more like three now that I think about it, just being in it with the patient, even if I wasn't necessarily prescribing a medication or prescribing a kind of psychotherapy, just being present with them allowed them the space to process what they were going through. And that's something that I think is, it forms the basis of a lot of psychiatry that's hard to articulate in a curriculum, but it definitely exists in real life.
Yeah, and hard to, I think, you know, like you say, a curriculum learned from a book or something like that. Adam, I want to ask you about relationships. You talk a little bit in the book about your own family and that you have a brother and a father, both of whom are physicians. But I think your brother, I think, went into internal medicine. And I think that is maybe also what your father is. And so how did that influence you and shape your own decisions about going into medicine and maybe a different field?
Yeah, we had a very interesting dynamic. We have to this day an interesting dynamic in my family, because for some reason, everybody seemed to think my brother should be a lawyer or a politician. He's very talkative and argumentative in a charming way, and people thought like that was his future. But he wanted to be a doctor, and he turned out to be a terrific cardiologist. He's working down in New York now. And our father is a cardiologist, and I went to medical school with the idea, I always liked psychology, but I went to medical school with the idea that, okay, I know psychology is really interesting to me, but what I want to do is something more akin to what I was familiar with what my father did, what I watched growing up, which is helping patients in a biological way. And so I went in through medical school, and I went in with the idea that I would do something like internal medicine, and then I looked back after the first couple of years, and I realized, you know, of all the didactic coursework, the stuff that I found most interesting was still the brain and behavior stuff. And then as I got into my clinical rotations, I looked back and said, well, you know, there's no field where the patient's story and what's most important to them is what should be most important to you as much as psychiatry. And something about that really connected with me, that idea that you could just barely do the basic job of being a psychiatrist if you aren't good at connecting with people. But there are other fields of medicine where that's probably less important. In psychiatry, it's like 90% connection, and then all the bells and whistles that we have, all the psychopharmacology and the neuromodulation and the psychotherapy, all that comes later. You can do a good job with those things, but you can do a much better job if you've already connected with the human being across the room from you. And so I really enjoyed that. I thought about, look, if I'm going to work for most of the rest of my life doing this job, I should probably go into a field where I feel like I'm good at it, and it's what's that I'll be really passionate about it. So I went into psychiatry, and then this book tells a story from that point forward where, you know, a lot of people may not realize that in medical school you are learning a lot of the foundational knowledge, right? But in residency you're learning by doing, and you're also building upon that knowledge from within your field. And so this book really tells that story of learning by doing. We all have these ideas about what is a psychiatrist? What are they all about? We have sort of some people have a stigmatized idea of what a psychiatrist is or what psychiatry is. Some people have an outdated, model of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Another will think of Dr. Melfi from The Sopranos.
Yes.
You know, all kinds of media portrayals. New Yorker cartoons have a ton of therapy kind of cartoons. So these are all portrayals that people think of. But this book, what I wanted to do was really give readers a sense of how you take a wide-eyed but inexperienced medical school graduate and turn them into a psychiatrist. And it's a journey that was wild and overwhelming at times, emotional at times, and also something I wouldn't trade for anything in the world.
There's one scene I wanted to bring up where I think, well, you're in training, that's the book, and your father, the cardiologist, asks you essentially a clinical question, and he sort of says, Adam, is this drug safe, or what's the dose of this drug, or is this going to affect, like, the electrocardiogram or something? And it was, like, really formative for you, because it was like your dad was, you know, he was still your dad, but he was treating you like a peer, and I think it felt really important.
Yeah, and in addition to that feeling, there was an added oomph to it, because When my brother and I were in medical school at the same time, we were separated by 3 years in age, but we went to medical school at the same years because my brother took some time off, and I went straight through. So when we were in medical school, we would go home for a Christmas week or whatever it might be, and we would start getting into this sort of competition about, like, who could bond with Dad the most about medicine, you know? And then when he went into internal medicine and I went into psychiatry, you know, I realized, you know, if this is a race, I'm going to lose this race, you know, because he's only going to learn more and more about internal medicine, and I'm going to be learning about other things. And so that moment when my father asks me that curbside consult about duloxetine dosing or whatever it might have been, it let me off the hook, because it taught me, A, you're still just father and son at its core, but B, you know, you can still have a little bit of that, you know, professional connection.
On the theme of relationships, you know, I think one of the teasers for the book in some of the PR material was sort of like Grey's Anatomy meets, you know, Fraser Crane or Dr. Melfi or something like that. And I think this book is very real. It's a memoir after all. But, you know, you do, as we talk about, falsify some things just for privacy's sake. But you write about the woman who became your wife, and sort of it starts out as sort of a little bit of a crush, and I think she kind of plays hard to get, and you also reveal sort of in the acknowledgments that, you know, she's a very private person and doesn't really want her life kind of splayed across magazine covers or whatever. Tell us a little bit about that. So you were in your training program meeting this person, you know, you weren't getting much in the way of reciprocation other than a little bit of, you know, palsy kind of friendship, and eventually it seems like things sort of worked out.
Absolutely. I don't think she was playing hard to get one iota. I think she was not interested in me romantically for the first 2 years that we, you know, maybe year and a half that we knew each other.
I read it differently. I was giving you the benefit of the doubt.
Thank you. I appreciate that. No, I was there, and I remember thinking, I mean, as it's laid out in the book, you know, there were moments where I said, okay, Adam, you know, like, She's not interested. It's cool. You know, to your listeners, I want to get across that, if anything, I'm a very passive. It was a very passive thing where I was trying to read between the lines to see, is this woman interested in me? And no, I guess not. You know, there was some scene where we all went on a vacation together when we all had off between first and second year, and she suggested that we share a room, and I said, oh, what, that must mean she's interested, and in fact, she was not at all interested. And it wasn't until later that our romance actually developed. But it remained an interesting thing where she is such a private person that she, you know, we were sort of dating in secret for a year and a half, something like that. And that was her choice, and I respected that. And eventually, fast forward about 10 years, I am coming up with the idea for this book, and I pitched it to my literary agent, and she said, that's a great idea. And I said, okay, now I have to get my wife on board. And so I brought it back to her, and I said, look, what do you think if I wrote a book like this? And, you know, we'll protect everyone's privacy. We have different techniques we can use for that. But, you know, what do you think? And she was on board. And we've had fun with it. But at the same time, she remains a somewhat private person. And so there is a certain degree of irony there.
Well, one of the humorous aspects, and you mentioned this, is she wanted to keep the relationship private. And clearly your residency classmates kind of knew this was going on and saw you guys sort of together a lot or leaving one various apartment or something together, and you were sort of like, well, I'm not going to say anything. And so you were right. Sort of keeping up this charade, but of course, you know, your friends always kind of know what's going on.
Right.
You're listening to Studio Tulsa. It's Medical Monday. I'm John Schumann. My guest today is Dr. Adam Stern, who is a neuropsychiatrist at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, where he studies, among other things, transcranial magnetic stimulation. And Adam, I want to ask you about that. He's also the author of a new memoir, a beautifully written memoir called Committed, about his time as a psychiatrist in training. You write, one of the experiences that really stuck with you and seemed to be a very, I mean, it sounds creepy in a way, a very positive experience, but was when you were working in something called ECT, electroconvulsive therapy. And for, you know, for lay listeners, that's just where you're using electricity to shock people who have severe depression or other severe conditions. And we still don't really know why it works, but it does seem to have pretty high efficacy. And it's also, you know, we have refined the practice, so where we're using much lower voltages. But tell us about what that experience was like and how it may have influenced your specific, like, career choice.
Absolutely. So one thing to know is that what a lot of people think electroconvulsive therapy is or looks like is based out of One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, you know, what they saw, this traumatic experience that they've seen in the movies or whatever they might be imagining. And the real-life version of it, one of the things I tried to convey in the book, in the chapter where ECT is featured, is how sort of mundane it is. The patient is under anesthesia. There's a little blood pressure cuff on one of their ankles. And you just, when the patient experiences an induced seizure, which is where the treatment gets its efficacy, you see that their foot sort of rocks back and forth for anywhere between 20 seconds and at most 2 minutes. It's the most incredibly mundane, you know, there's nothing really shocking about it besides the fact that there's electricity being used. And then afterwards, the anesthesiologist sort of wakes the patient up gently, they come out of it, and ideally, you know, within about 10 or 12 treatments, someone's feeling a lot better. You know, like you said, response rates for ECT are some of the highest that we have in psychiatry for really severe mood disorders, things like really severe depression or bipolar depression or suicidality. These are things that if they're not responding to first lines of care like medications and therapy, ECT is still a good thing to consider. One of the things we have to do is try to overcome the stigma that still exists in the year 2021 around it. But I will say that seeing this, I loved it because it taught me that even in this field where the person is still the most important aspect of what you're doing, understanding who they are and what their goals are for the treatment, you could still rely on a biological approach. I really gravitated toward that idea. And so later in my residency, when I was exposed to something called neuromodulation, which came in this case in the form of something called transcranial magnetic stimulation, or TMS for short, I was really intrigued because I saw this as the future of psychiatry, and I still do, frankly, is non-invasive brain stimulation. So the more we learn about the brain, the more we understand how it functions and then how it dysfunctions in mental health disorders. And what we're learning is that there are functionally connected networks in the brain, different parts of the brain that communicate. And when someone's severely depressed, for example, certain networks aren't functioning the way they need to. So certain nodes, little parts within the network in the brain are not as active or excitable as it should be. And so what TMS does is it uses a magnetic field that pulsates on and off to basically tell your brain, that particular little part of the brain, to be more active. And what we find is if you do that once, not much happens. But if you do that for a few weeks in a row, people actually do really well. And it's not the kind of thing like ECT where you need anesthesia. There are no memory side effects. So it was still in its relative infancy when I got on board in residency. But now it's about 10 years later, it's a more foundational treatment option for people with treatment-resistant depression.
So who's referring patients to you? Is it other mental health practitioners, or do, you know, sort of primary care folks say, hey, I've heard about this neuromodulation, I want to, you know, see if this will benefit my patient, or they've had a bad experience with certain medications? Like, where do the patients come from?
It is mostly psychiatrists and therapists that are referring, and the reason is that it's a 6-week commitment in the late sense. So, you know, it's a time commitment. You have to come into the center and get the treatment. It's an hour out of your day, 5 days a week for, a month and a half or something like that. And so people aren't doing it when they first become depressed. They're doing it when they're depressed and they've had a medication trial and it hasn't worked, and another medication trial and that hasn't worked, and maybe an augmentation, you know, where they try to add on a medication to an antidepressant and that still hasn't worked, then you might, you know, consider something like TMS. And so that's why a lot of the people that are referred in for a treatment like this, they already have a psychiatrist that works with them longitudinally, and we're just sort of the consultants.
Of course, everyone's going to want to know, is this something insurance covers? Is it out of the experimental, and is it in the more generally accepted phase, or is it still something that has to get like lots of pre-approval, prior authorization, all that kind of stuff?
Yeah, right. It's both of those. So it is covered. It's now covered by all jurisdictions of Medicare in the United States, and it is covered by most private insurers as well. But the challenge is that they often will say you have to have tried and not responded to something like 4 different antidepressants before you're eligible. You have to have tried a therapy that's quote-unquote evidence-based with scales that document you weren't getting better. So as often happens, the people who are in charge of the reimbursement for procedures might hold more influence when it comes to whether or not you are going to be able to get the treatment. You have to fit just the right criteria to be able to get it in some cases.
Okay, well, thanks for teaching us about that. It's very interesting. Adam, I want to ask about your writing career, because you actually have written, I mean, you became a writer. You've written this memoir, and you mentioned the fact that you were pitching this idea to a literary agent. Well, not all doctors have literary agents. So how did you even get a literary agent? How did that all start?
It reminds me of the serendipity of life, and in all the positive and negative ways, it's hard to predict how your life is going to go, even when tragedy strikes. And so I'll tell you that I've enjoyed writing for as long as I can remember, stories and, you know, just even essays, things that were methods by which I could process my inner world. And that was fine. And in medical school, I wrote for some medical literary journals, and that was fun. And when I went into medicine, I really started to focus more on my career, and I said, okay, well, that could just sort of be a hobby that I put on the back burner. But in 2018, I was actually diagnosed with a serious kidney cancer. It's a life-threatening condition for me, and that's like when I was a healthy 33-year-old with your whole adult life ahead of you, that's a really earth-shattering kind of thing. And I found myself starting to write again, because the experience was so strange, and I needed to figure out a way to cope. I needed to understand how to process what I was going through. And so I started to write these essays. And actually, my very first essay that I wrote, I wrote this thing, I don't know what to do with it. I brought it to the media relations department at my medical center, and they said, oh, well, we know someone at Boston's NPR, WBUR, and we'll send it there and see what they do. And so they actually took it and put it on their website, and I was on their radio, I read it on the radio, I was like, wow, this is actually really kind of interesting and fun and a way to help me sort of cope with what I'm dealing with. So then I started to do that, and I learned more and more about being a doctor and a patient at the same time, and I started writing more and more about my experience, and some of these things ended up in really well-read places like the New York Times, the New England Journal of Medicine, JAMA, all these places that got a lot of attention. And there was something about the level of radical self-disclosure that I was doing in these pieces that I think came across as genuine, that people connected with. And so I found, quote-unquote, more success in my writing than ever before, and that success actually translated to a literary agent reaching out to me and saying, hey, have you thought about writing a book? And we put our heads, as I said, only my whole life, you know, so we put our heads together, and we thought about what book I could write, and this is going to sound sad or maybe funny, I'm not sure, but basically we came to the conclusion that, like, cancer memoirs don't sell very well. That story's been written a lot, and really well. There are some classics, like When Breath Becomes Air is an amazing book written by a late doctor who died with cancer.
Paul Kalanithi, right, young neurosurgeon, yeah.
Yeah, and so, you know, we said, let's refocus and try to think of what's a story that you can tell that people will gravitate to that will involve this level of self-disclosure. And I thought my transition from medical student to psychiatrist was the most interesting story of my life and meeting my wife in that process. And so that's where the book came from.
Aha, and that's why you had to get her permission.
And
is
absolutely.
That, so, and you said, you know, the cancer memoir is a well-paved genre, so to speak. So is that, and that's why you chose to kind of keep that part separate, the cancer? Are you okay now from all that? It's a few years ago now, is it not?
It's a few years ago. I do have advanced disease. I have metastatic disease. My last scan didn't show any cancer, but the scan before that showed a small nodule on my other kidney, which we dealt with. So the bottom line, thank you for asking. The bottom line is that I'm doing well today, and I'll, you know, for the rest of my life, I'll have scans, and we'll try to get ahead of anything that pops up. And, you know, one of the most exciting things that I like to follow in my spare time is the progress that cancer doctors are making, and they're making amazing progress, in particular in the area of immunotherapies, and localized treatments, things like radiation and cryoablation and all these techniques that never probably existed 20 or 30 years ago in the way they do now. And there are so many medications available for a guy like me that I have learned to try to live my life in these 3 or 4 month increments as fully as I can from scan to scan without thinking too much about the cancer in between. And then when I have to do something related to my health, I do the best I can with it. And I'm very fortunate to have access to some of the best care in the world. And you know, I have a wonderful medical team, and I'm fortunate and thankful for that every day.
Wow. Well, thank you for sharing that with us. The name of the book is Committed, Dispatches from a Psychiatrist in Training. It's by my guest today, Dr. Adam Stern, who is a neuropsychiatrist at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Adam Stern, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a real pleasure to talk with you.
Adam Stern is a neuropsychiatrist at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. His new memoir is titled Committed, Dispatches from a Psychiatrist in Training. Well, that's our show for this Medical Monday. Studio Tulsa is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of KWGS or the University of Tulsa. For Studio Tulsa, I'm John Schumann with Medical Monday. Thanks for listening, and please stay safe out there.